Dear friends, ULT Bangalore welcomes you to today's short talk followed by discussion on the subject, the festival of the spring equinox. So we must first ask the question, what is an equinox? It is an astronomical event. We can understand it this way. We all know that the earth rotates around its own axis, that produces day and night, and then it revolves around the sun, and one revolution around the sun taking around 365 days, which produces an year. Now we must understand that the axis of the earth, in the axis of the earth, there is a slight tilt. The earth does not rotate around itself in a straight axis and thus revolve around the sun, but there is a slight tilt in the axis of the earth. And this axial tilt in the earth and its revolution around the sun is what produces the seasons, the four seasons that we know of. So, equinox is an astronomical event which occurs twice in a year. Once during, sometime during the end of March, which is called as the spring equinox. And then 6 months later, in the end of September, called as the autumnal equinox. The word equinox itself means equal night. Equus nox, equal night. So it is that point, that part of the year where the days and nights are of equal duration, 12-hour day, 12-hour night. So in spring, which in the northern hemisphere, spring would be during March, April and May. Spring is a time when there is a renewal of life on earth. The winter has just ended during December, January and February. And due to this axial tilt, the next 6 months will be an increase of daylight. So from the point of equinox, which is March 21st this year, sunlight, there is an increase of sunlight on earth and everything grows, everything, it is as if nature is resurrected, there is a rebirth in nature. From the coldness and darkness of winter, there is a shift and then more and more sunlight is infused into earth and everything grows. So spring is seen as a period of activity, a period of resurrection. So this event is not merely astronomical event, but this was celebrated across various nations and cultures. This period of spring equinox was celebrated. So what we will do in today's talk is to consider the various traditions and customs and see what they symbolize and try to decipher their meaning and try to see what are the lessons which are implicit in these festivals, in these celebrations. So let's consider a few of the customs to begin with. It is said that the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Scandinavians, the Norsemen, all of them worshipped the egg. And during this period of spring, it is said that Norsemen exchanged colored eggs in commemoration of their god, which is Ostara. So Ostara was a goddess of fertility, the queen of the springtime, the queen of springtime. And etymologically, Ostara comes from the word Aws, Avis, which means to shine, to shine. And it is said that this answers to the Greek god of Eos, or the Roman Aurora, or the Hindu Ushas. And in the Hindu belief, it is said that the mundane egg in which Brahma gestated broke and Brahma arose during the springtime. All this is, we should remember, all this is very symbolical. The pagan Ostara, the goddess of springtime, the queen of springtime, it is from this word Ostara that the word Easter is derived. We find that Easter is celebrated sometime soon. That is Easter being celebrated after the on the first Sunday after the first full moon day after the spring equinox. That is when Easter is celebrated. And Easter itself is, the word itself is derived from this pagan word Ostara, the goddess of Ostara, the goddess Ostara. The story goes that everything was dark and cold on earth, everything was asleep, and then Ostara comes on earth and sees that everything is asleep, and at the right time everything has to wake up, and then she realizes that she was sent on earth to wake everything up, to wake up everything, to awaken everything. So this tradition of Easter, we must remember, and we will see subsequently, is not something new. The Christian tradition have copied from the pagan festivals which were celebrated in the ancient traditions from long time. So we all know the story of resurrection. Just to recollect it, it is said that Christ was crucified on the cross, and then his body is removed from the cross and he is put in a stone tomb, and a stone wall is closed, and that is on the Friday they do that, which they call as Good Friday. And then after 2 days, when they open the tomb, they see that Christ is no more there, Jesus is no more there, but he is resurrected. That is when Easter is celebrated. Now we must try to understand the meaning of who is Christ, and what is meant by crucifixion, what is this resurrection that happens. These all in the course of talk we will try to understand. And something very similar to this was followed in the ancient Rome, in the traditions of ancient Rome. A 10-day rite in the honor of the god Attis was celebrated in ancient Rome, much before the Christian era. So let me explain what they did during this rite. A pine tree was cut, a pine tree representing the god Attis. It was chopped, and then the pine was wrapped in linen, and then it was placed in a sepulchre on Friday, which they call as the Black Friday. And after 2 days, they open the sepulchre at the dawn and show that the sepulchre is empty, the pine is not there, meaning that the god Attis is resurrected. And this day of resurrection they used to celebrate as Hilaria, or the day of joy. So we see that the pagan traditions are the origin, prototypes in a way, on which the Christian theology have built their traditions. when the ancients celebrated the renewal of nature during this time, during the springtime, Christian theology adopted these traditions, and we find the resurrection of Christ, where the resurrection of nature is mentioned in the pagan traditions. The resurrection of Christ is, the Christian theology has mentions this. And again, just to recollect one more correspondence between the life of Jesus Christ and an old god, old tradition which mentions, the Roman tradition which mentions the god Mithras. The god Mithras also was born during winter solstice, which is during December, when the birthday of Jesus Christ is, when the birthday of Jesus Christ is celebrated. And he was also resurrected in spring, which is when Easter is celebrated. So we find there's so many similarities between the traditions. And another interesting thing is the Mayan traditions. There's an interesting phenomena that occurs during equinox in one of the pyramids, the Mayan pyramids, called as Chichen Itza. The name of the pyramid is Chichen Itza. That is, on the equinoctial day, spring equinoctial day, when the rays of the sun fall on the western wall of the pyramid, it casts a shadow on the northern stair of that pyramid, such that from the top of the staircase to the bottom of the staircase, a serpent with a diamond back is proceeding. So they celebrate this as the return of the sun serpent. So we find that equinox, the spring equinox, is celebrated in various ways across various traditions, and all of this is profoundly symbolical. And Persians, they celebrated this as Nowruz, which means the new day. It was a 13-day celebration where they purified their house. Let's remember this. They purified their house and they leapt over fire. That's what the tradition says. And if we go to Judaism, we find that Jews celebrate one of their most significant festivals is the festival of Passover, which is, they celebrate during this time of equinox the exodus of Jews from Egypt, where they were liberated from slavery and they moved out of Egypt. So there is darkness and slavery, and then Jews are liberated, and during this equinoctial time an exodus happens, a movement away from Egypt happens, and they are liberated from their slavery. Again, very symbolical. And of course, we all know that the Hindu New Year begins on Yugadi or Samvatsaradi, the beginning of the new Yuga or the beginning of the new Samvatsara. So these are just a few selected traditions, and there's so much symbology in this. And these are not merely stories and tales, but all these traditions contain deep philosophical meaning. Unfortunately, all this is more or less brushed aside as superstition by so-called scientific minds of today, and it is laughed at by many of us today. But the ancients were very wise. All their traditions were built such that in their core they symbolized some great truths. The symbology of the egg, the return of the serpent, the resurrection of Christ, resurrection of God Attis. All this is very symbolical and contain profound teachings which are hidden in it. They understood that the physical nature imitates the spiritual nature. As St. Paul says, this world is an enigmatic mirror of pure truth. So all the astronomical events, events of the world, when you are able to read them correctly, they signify some spiritual truth. When we are able to decipher the meaning, we get the philosophical essence of the tradition. So let's begin by considering this recurrence of seasons. These seasons we see are cyclical. We have spring now, which will proceed into summer, and then into autumn, and then again winter, and the next year there is again spring. There is again a renewal of nature. There is an increase of daylight, and then gradually there is decrease of daylight. It doesn't die there. There is again another wave of life, another wave of activity. This shows us the first lesson, which is that everything in nature is cyclical. Everything in nature follows the law of recurrence, follows the law of cycles. There is day and night. We begin our activity with the day, and we reach the zenith, the peak, and then we get tired, and during the approach of night, we also fall asleep. So our sleeping and waking cycle is interwoven with night and day, of which is again the rotation of the earth around its own axis. There is the in-breathing and out-breathing, the systole and diastole, the circadian rhythm. And then in the newspaper we are reading just day before yesterday and a few days before that, that there is an increase in the activity of the sun, which means in terms of the sun flares, which are the solar flares, have an increased activity. There is an increased activity of solar flares which is reaching the earth, and astronomers say that in the last 10 years this is whatever the amount of solar flares that has happened, in just this year it has exceeded. Just this year solar flares have exceeded as compared to the last 10 years, last decade. And they say that there is an 11-year cycle of sun's activity. Sun goes into an active phase for 11 years and then a passive phase for 11 years. So they say that we are entering the active phase of sun's active phase in the coming year, this year and the coming year. So again we see cycles here. So just to recollect what Krishna says in the 8th chapter of the Gita, all worlds up to that of Brahman are subject to rebirth again and again, again and again, again and again. So there is a definite law, a fundamental law of cycles which is working. And the whole universe itself, ancients say, proceeds along this law of cycles. It arises from the unknown, and then there is a period of activity, and then there is a period of rest, like a sinusoidal wave, perfect sinusoidal wave. And this whole period of activity that we see, this vast number of creatures that we see, all of them here, what is the purpose of all this? What is the end and aim of all this? Is there any meaning to all this? Sage Patanjali answers this very profound question in one of his aphorisms, in the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali. And he answers this in the 18th aphorism of Book 2, where he says, the universe including the visible and the invisible, the essential nature of which is compounded of purity, action and rest, and which consists of the elements and organs of action, exists for the sake of soul's experience and emancipation. So we find that the whole of the manifested universe, with all the different diverse creatures, with so many different kinds of conditions, so complex in its nature, all of this exists for the experience of soul, and through that experience, emancipation of the soul. And just like spring brings back life to earth, spring brings back activity to earth, so also we find, in the sense that just like there is a resurrection of activity on earth during springtime, so also man, there is a resurrection of man. The death of the physical body is the end of only the physical frame. The winter, which is dark and cold, is not the end of all. There is a resurrection of nature that happens. Similarly, at the time of physical death, it's not the end of man. Man does not come into existence when he was born out of the womb of his mother, nor does he end his existence at the time of his death. But just like spring renews life again and again, he goes from one body to another again and again, which is very nicely explained by Krishna in the second chapter of the Gita, when he says to Arjuna, "As a man throws away old garments and puts on new, even so the dweller in the body, having quit its old mortal frames, entereth into others which are new." So this we must remember, that the destruction is only for the name and form, only for the personality. But the essence of man, the most important aspect of man, rather the only important aspect of man, is eternal. It is unchanging. And this fundamental teaching must be ever borne in mind in order for us to understand any of the ancient teachings. They all teachers bring back to our mind through various means, using various expressions, using various traditions, using various customs, this fact that man is spiritual in his origin, and he is spiritual in his innermost nature. All true teachers speak of this. All true teachers point to the God within each one of us. They remind us of the divine conscience within, which is within every single one of us. So this being the condition, this being the essential nature of man, then why are we in so much sorrow? Why are we in such dire conditions, such a sorry state? Why? If we are gods, if we are all powerful, if we are divine, then why are we always bounded, limited, and fettered by one or the other kind of conditions? Where does evil arise from? If our primary nature is goodness, then why do we find evil in the world, which is nothing but in reflection of the evil within each one of us? So the teachers say that though the essence of man is spiritual, there's no doubt about it. Essence of man is immortal, unchanging. Yet he is in touch with what is non-eternal. Though he is eternal, he is situated among non-eternal, constantly changing things. And due to this contact with what is not of his nature, if he loses sight of his own real nature when he is in touch with what is non-eternal, then this delusion arises. We are studying in our Key to Theosophy study, where Plato is mentioned. He says that the mind of man, Syushe, lies between nous, or we may say divine intellect at one end, and on the other end there is anoia, or irrational mind, irrational soul, animal tendencies. So the mind of man rests between these two. The complete responsibility, or what to say, the complete future, the future of man completely depends on whether the mind of man chooses to gravitate towards nous, which is divine intellect, or chooses to get bogged down and fettered by anoia, which is irrational soul. So Plato says that when Syushe works in tandem with nous, then everything it does is felicitous. Everything that it does is aright. Everything that it does brings forth the best possible results. On the other hand, its opposite happens when it chooses anoia. So this is the condition of man, and so nicely explained by Shankaracharya in Viveka Chudamani. Let me read these two verses. He says, "The belief that the Anatman is the Atman is man's bondage." Where does bondage arise from? This basic confusion, this basic misunderstanding of self and non-self. He further says, "This belief arises from avidya. It is the cause of the congeries of griefs like birth, death, etc. By it, thinking this unreal body to be real like the Atman, one nourishes it, bathes it, protects it by sense objects, and gets bound by them like the silkworm by its threads. By ajnana, which is the nature of tamas, an undiscriminating mind, undiscriminating man, mistakes what is not a thing as that thing. This is due to lack of discrimination. This is like thinking a serpent to be a rope. Then great calamities befall one subject to it. Hence, listen, my friend, taking unreal things to be real is what constitutes bondage." This is what Shankara says. And this is the present condition of the general mankind, all of us. We are bound by misunderstanding what is unreal to be real. We have divine conscience, but it is crucified by passion. We have the voice of spirit within us, but crucified by the voice of flesh. So we see here the symbol of Christ. What does Christ symbolize? It symbolizes the real, inner, eternal man. The divine principle within each one of us. And the cross on which Jesus was said to be crucified is this body. This body is the cross of flesh, within which the divine conscience, the divine principle is crucified. The nails are the nails of passion. And you see, if you draw a cross There are separate parts in each one of it. If you close all of them, it becomes a cube. A cube is what contains. A cube is like a bondage, a symbol of bondage. So we see that crucifixion is happening every day, every moment within each one of us if we are not listening to the voice of conscience within us. If the divine qualities which Krishna enumerates in the 16th chapter of the Gita is not evident in our character, is not evident in our daily living, then we have turned towards demonical nature, and that is crucifixion. That is crucifixion. So a similar story in the Greek mythology is that of Prometheus. Prometheus, son of Zeus, to benefit mankind who are in again coldness and darkness, brings the heavenly fire, and for this mischief he is punished. As the mythology says, he is punished by Zeus by chaining him, chaining Prometheus to the Mount of Caucasus. And in the Mount of Caucasus, he is said to undergo eternal torture, where the vultures pluck his flesh and eat on his flesh. Again, this is very symbolical, very similar to the crucifixion of Christ, and it symbolizes the same thing. In man, the mind being lit up by the divine beings, they brought the fire, the heavenly fire of mind, and that divinity within us is crucified, is chained to the Mount Caucasus. The Mount Caucasus being the body of flesh, and constantly plucked by vultures and tortured by vultures, the vultures of passion, the vultures of anger, the vultures of all our lower tendencies. And it further says that Prometheus will be liberated, just like Jesus was resurrected. Prometheus will be liberated when his son comes to his rescue. We'll consider this symbology in a while, but very significant. Shankara says in the same text, Uddharet Atmana Atmana. Let me read this verse. By attaining to a state of Yoga Ruda, by firm knowledge of Brahman, let one raise one's impure mind steeped in the ocean of samsara by one's pure mind. So we see that there are two aspects in us. The impure aspect of us, which is steeped in the ocean of samsara, this has to be raised with the help of the pure aspect of us. As Plato says, by the help of nous, Sushe has to liberate itself from the fetters of anoya. This is, when this is completely accomplished, when this grand end and aim of soul for which this whole universe exists, emancipation of the soul is accomplished, that is again symbolized by resurrection. The resurrection of Christ. So this is what is symbolized in all the various traditions that we see. We see that there are demonical elements in us, and then there is divine elements in us. Krishna clearly enumerates this in the 16th chapter. And we stand between them. And where does our mind incline? Where does Shushe incline? In the absence of the knowledge of divinity within us, the Christos within us, the Krishna within the chariot of this body, in the absence of that knowledge, then we identify ourselves with body. We identify ourselves with the conditions of the body. Then we are involved in sorrow. Then we are involved in expectations. then we are involved in pain, then we are involved in disappointments. Then, as Shankara says, we bathe it, we protect it, we think that we are this body. That is, as Shankara says, in the absence of knowledge. And he makes a very important statement in the same text, where he says, he who wishes to realize the Atman through the indulgence of the body is one who wishes to cross a river on the back of a crocodile, thinking it is a log of wood. For the seeker of liberation, attachment to the body is the great death. The body dies and goes, it's cyclical. That is not death. Attachment to body is the great death. He alone deserves liberation who is free from this attachment. And how is this resurrection of the self within us to be effected? Let's see what he says in the same text. I'll read this one verse. Let one read the Shastras, sacrifice to the gods, perform karmas, or meditate on the divinities. Liberation will not arise even after hundreds of Brahmakalpas without knowledge of the unity of Atman. Without knowledge of the unity of Atman. So he clearly mentions, he makes it very clear that knowledge of the Christ within us is the first step towards resurrection of Christ, to use a symbolical language. So we must take knowledge and shape our life accordingly. And then, just like a butterfly, a larvae which has built a cocoon around itself, and then it breaks free from it and flies out of it like a butterfly, then we are able to fly out of it, fly out of this conditioned existence, full of sorrow, the mansions of pain and death. These are the mansions of pain and death. We can fly out of it, the wings signifying our freedom. And this again begins with the purification of mind. Our mind is so full of wrong ideas that it leads to bondage invariably. So we saw how the Persians celebrate this festival by purifying their house. From top to bottom they purify and clean their house, signifying that this resurrection begins with purification of mind. Their day, their celebration of Nowruz, the preceding day, it is said that they clean their house, purify their house. Symbolical of the cleaning of mind, the cleaning of heart, the cleaning of our intentions that has to take place before resurrection of the spirit within us can be effected. Now let's consider another symbol which we saw in the various traditions, the symbol of egg. This again denotes resurrection and rebirth. In a way, it denotes eternal life. We see that there is an egg. The egg hatches and a bird comes. And then the bird again lays another egg. Again the egg hatches and another bird comes out. So there is a recurrence, a renewal of life. A renewal of life, like a phoenix, the bird phoenix. If that is one thing that we can understand, which again refers to the great eternal essence within us, which is immortal. The bodies come and go, but there is an immortal part in us. Another meaning that we can derive from this symbol of egg is the shell versus the essence. The body is the shell. What we see is only the outer covering, the shell. But the essence of man is deep within each one of us. So there is a shell and an inner essence. What is important to all of us is the essence of the egg and not the outer covering. So also the outer is just a shell which is there to contain, like a vehicle, a upadhi, contain the real essence. The same thing we see in the scriptures also. There is an outer covering, merkava, as the Jewish Kabbalists speak of. An outer covering, an exoteric meaning. And then there is an inner essence, a deep Gupta Vidya. You may see just the shell, outer shell, and think that this is all that is there. But inside there is life in it. Inside there is vitality. If these are some meanings that we can derive from the egg, the symbol of egg, another very evident lesson that we can draw from this symbol is our action and its consequences. If a hen lays an egg, if a particular type of bird lays an egg, the egg does not give rise to another kind of bird. A peacock lays an egg, a peacock comes out. Peacock is what hatches and comes out. So this refers to the consequences of our thoughts and actions. Doesn't Buddha begin the teachings in Dhammapada by this most important teaching, that all that we are is the result of what we have thought. All that we are is founded on our thoughts and formed of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain pursues him, as the wheel of the wagon follows the hoof of the ox that draws it. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. All that we are is founded on our thoughts and formed of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness pursues him as his own shadow that never leaves him. So we see that there is cause and effect, which the egg again symbolizes. What are the kinds of, what is the kind of egg in quote that we are laying, which will hatch in the future and which we will have to face, the consequences of which we will have to face. So it refers to the recurrence of action. Just like spring comes again and again, so also what we have done comes back to us. We may have done it in the silent recesses of our heart, or very openly and publicly. All of it is recorded, all of it is noted, memorized, stored, recorded. And at the appropriate moment, the consequences are brought forward, brought to us. So, just think about this. All that we have done in our past years have its effect on us today. All the decisions that we have taken, all the mistakes that we have done, all the good things that we have done, all of it has its bearing on what we are today. In the past 20, 30, 40, 50, how many number of years, so it may be. Everything that we have done has its consequences of what we are today. Similarly also, everything that we have done in our past lives will have its bearing. And just like today, we have the power to change the course of our action. Of course, the past has its effect on us, but it's not completely binding us. There is a element of free will which is always inherent in man, because he is spirit. So we can use that free will and grow beyond the limitations of matter which we have built around for ourselves. So in the present there is always the power of change. And let's consider one's final attempt to understand this symbol of seasons, and then we can take up any questions. So we see that light traverses, the sunlight in a way traverses through the year. There is a summer when it is brightest, then there is fall, then there is winter where there is coldness and darkness, and then the season of resurrection. So this cyclical motion of light traversing through the earth in a way, again symbolizes how ancient doctrines, ancient wisdom is revived again and again. Light is resurrected at one point, and then humanity, the human fancy works upon the teachings that the teachers have given and builds superstition around it, builds a religion around it. A cult is formed, a sect is formed, and so on and so forth. Then there it goes into darkness. Then again there is a period of resurrection, and the teachings are revived. So this again refers to cyclical renewal of spiritual wisdom in the mind, in human mind. And again, let's remember that Nowruz, which the Iranians, the Persians celebrated, was preceded by purification of their house. Similarly, in order for us to receive these spiritual instructions, a preliminary purification of mind is necessary. Just like spring gives new life to earth, more sunlight to earth and more activity and vegetation, and resurrects nature, so also spiritual wisdom is what can revive the man from his present condition of winter, in a way, coldness and darkness. A spiritual wisdom alone can revive man.